You've got business travel to do, and you own a great airplane to make that trip GA without dealing with the vagaries of commercial airline travel. Your plane is a Mooney, and it's your friend. But is it? You've been in the plane for a couple of hours, and you've developed a headache and a bit of anxiety. What's the cause? It could be carbon monoxide poisoning, but you don't find out until it's too late. After you've crashed. We'll hear all about it on this episode of I Laughed. I learned about flying from that. Hello, and welcome to episode 22 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by Avemco. I'm Rob Ryder, and my guest on today's program is Dan Bass. He's a flight instructor who thought that CO poisoning was something he knew how to detect and avoid. But the insidious nature of that sickness overtook him in ways that he only now understands. He survived a crash landing, and he'll share the story and the very valuable lessons he learned right after we hear a word from the Avemco Aviation Insurance Company. For 60 years, Avemco has been the only aircraft insurance company that lets you speak directly with a decision maker empowered to approve coverage based on your unique situation. Call 800-338-8705 for a free quote, and you'll save an instant 5% for being an I Laughed listener. Save even more for recurrent training, a new rating, or participating in a Fast Team Wings course. Call 800-338-8705 or visit avemco.com/flying. Now, I learned about flying from that. Dan Bass, welcome to the I Learned About Flying From That podcast. And boy, you did learn some stuff, didn't you?
I did. Thanks, Rob. It's good to be here.
Yeah, glad you are. Tell me, if you will, a little bit about what got you into flying and why you then moved into that marvelous Mooney that you sadly crash-landed later on.
Well, I got into flying through, like a lot of us, and I was very lucky in that my dad flew when I was growing up, so I was always around airplanes. He had several different airplanes while I grew up, and it's kind of all I wanted to do. So once I was about 15, I started getting ready for the big 16th birthday solo flight and got that done, and then got my private on my 17th.
And the rest is history. Have you been a professional pilot, or is this something that you have perhaps used for business or primarily pleasure?
Well, I always wanted to be a professional pilot. That's what put me down the road, and that never came to fruition. Different life events and kind of kept me on a different path. But I always flew. I ended up owning my own planes, and obviously for pleasure, but some business mixed in there for travel.
What was your first airplane?
My first airplane was an Air Coupe, 1946 Air Coupe, and I still have it.
Wow. And you still have it. Do you fly it often?
Unfortunately, no. I took it apart to do some maintenance on it when I had the Mooney, so I had two airplanes. And I find out when you have two airplanes, at least for me personally, I tend to gravitate towards the one that flies and neglect the one that doesn't. So it's still a project stage right now. But I did put about 1,000 hours on that airplane before I did park it.
Marvelous. Well, you certainly, when you got the Mooney, got yourself a performance increase that probably made a big difference as well.
It sure did, yeah. And it was a C model Mooney. So I always tell people it's the slowest of the Moonies, basically. But it was still quite an increase in performance over the Air Coupe.
And retractable gear and all the complex airplane and that, all that made for what I assume was a darned good instrument airplane and cross-country machine.
It was nicely equipped. It had a Garmin 530 and had a decent autopilot, and we used it as a family. I used it for business. We traveled coast to coast with it, the Bahamas, Pacific Northwest. It's been all over. It was a great airplane.
I say it was because I've seen pictures of what eventually happened. Your experience in this particular flight is one that is so scary, as I have read about it and heard about it, that the insidious nature of carbon monoxide had you totally confused and bamboozled. So tell you what, why don't you take us from the flight you had planned, and then let's go through step by step to the point where you don't remember anything, and then go to the point at which you do remember things. Where was this flight originating, and where were you headed?
Well, the flight of the accident was originating in Duluth, Minnesota, and I was heading back to my home base in Winona, Minnesota. Leading up to that, though, earlier in the morning, I left Winona and I flew to Thunder Bay, Canada, for business. This was a business trip. And on that flight, it was about a 2.5 hour long flight. It was really cold in the morning. Surface temps were around zero most of the region, but it was a high pressure system and it was beautiful weather. And on that flight, while I was climbing out of Winona about 6:30 in the morning, I had something that caught in my eye, and I started kind of rubbing my eye, and my first thought was, could this be carbon monoxide poisoning, you know, because it's the winter and carbon monoxide poisoning was always on my mind. I'm a CFI and I've learned about it through all my training over the years. And I always assume that if it's in the winter time, it's higher risk. And if I'm running the heater, but at that point, I quickly realized that carbon monoxide had nothing to do with my eye. And that was the last I thought about it. And
did you have a CO, little CO patch there on the panel?
No, I didn't. And part of that was, I thought that I was going to be able to be, if I was aware of the symptoms, I thought I wouldn't have any trouble recognizing them, especially because I was already at a kind of a higher level or of alertness, expecting it because it was the winter and I was running my heater. And then also as a CFI, so many times I've flown with other people in their airplanes and they'll have the little patch and the expiration date on there will be several years past. And so I always thought they were kind of ridiculous. But so I did not have that, unfortunately.
All right. So you take off from, you go up to Thunder Bay and then you went to Duluth after that?
Right. So I flew up to Thunder Bay in the morning and I did get a slight headache at the end of the flight. The headache increased after I was out of the airplane and trying to go about my business. And I had a few other interesting physiological symptoms outside of the airplane. The first one was this feeling of anxiety, which I rarely get anxious or feel anxiety. But I associated that with a mix-up I had with organizing and clearing into customs. I had mistakenly thought that Thunder Bay was on Central Time Zone, as it is for the United States, and it turned out it was Eastern Time, so my arrival time was off, and that caused some confusion with Canadian Customs. And that's about the time I started to feel the anxiety. And then the headache wasn't unusual for me if I didn't have caffeine, which I didn't yet this morning. So I had a headache and I had anxiety, both of which I was able to explain away with the circumstances.
Did you get some coffee? Did the coffee help when you finally got some?
Well, it seemed to. Yeah, I got some coffee at lunchtime, and by the afternoon, I felt fine. I didn't have a headache. So I spent 5-6 hours in Thunder Bay, and then I loaded up in the airplane and got ready to fly back to the States, and I had to clear customs, and the most logical place was Duluth, Minnesota, and that was about an hour-long flight, a little over an hour, and I took off and flew that flight, and I'd filed my EAPIS and called customs, and I was on an IFR flight plan, and everything was running smooth and working out, and I landed in Duluth, and the second I got out of my airplane and I stood up on the wing, I had this splitting headache. I didn't have the headache in the plane. I had it when I got out of the plane.
That's so strange.
Yeah, it was strange. And then this was, I explained this away by, I got out and did the work with the customs agent, and we he hurried around the airplane. It was so cold out, and we sprinted inside and filled out the paperwork. And at this point, my daughter, who at the time was 4 and a half, she had been kind of ill all week. And with a 4 and a half year old, they can't explain to you exactly what's wrong, but we just knew she was sick and not feeling well. So my headache was pretty strong at this point. And I had that stuff from the morning, and I just kind of assumed maybe I'm getting what she had. And so it was another way I kind of explained it away. And another thing that was, that I think was a unique learning experience here, was that all my symptoms really weren't while I was in the airplane. They were when I was out of the airplane. And I wouldn't have expected that.
Very strange. And what year again was this?
This was in 2017, February 2017.
So you're loaded for bear equipment-wise that's going to get you there with a great airplane. At least it seemed to be a great airplane, but it had a problem that had you totally baffled because you didn't even know the problem was there.
Right, right. Yeah, and so I cleared customs in Duluth, and this is when everything, the chain kind of started to kind of break down, and all these warning signs were there. I cleared customs in Duluth. I got the airplane squared away. I called my wife. At this time now, it's dinner time. It's dark because it's winter. And I called her and I said that I would be home in about an hour and didn't need to save dinner for me or anything. And I did mention to her that I had a headache and I just wanted to get home. So I run out to the airplane, and it's really cold. I load up, and I did not file my IFR flight plan yet. So I did that with my iPad in the plane, and then I was waiting.
With the engine running.
With the engine running, that's right. Yeah, because I didn't want it to get cold soaked and have trouble starting. So got the engine running and filed the flight plan, and I was waiting for the notification on my iPad that it was in the system. And I think I was using Garmin Pilot at the time, and it would send me a notification, as I knew I couldn't get my clearance until I got that. So I took that time to organize the cockpit and tidy up everything. And on the seat next to me, I had my hat and my gloves and my flashlight and just getting ready for the night flight. I put my headlamp on, all the while idling on the ground. Once it was in the system, I called and got my clearance, and there's ATC recordings of that. And when I look back on them now, that initial radio call to get my clearance, I can tell that I'm impaired. At the time, of course, I didn't know it.
Let's listen to that.
Duluth 9, Mooney 9-1-4-9, Victor.
Mooney 9-1-4-9, Victor, Duluth Ground.
Yeah, Mooney 4-9, Victor, we're over here at the FBO with information Sierra. We're ready to copy our IFR to Winona.
Mooney 49 Victor, clear the Winona airport as filed. Maintain 6,000, expect 9,000, 10 minutes after departure. Departure frequency 125.45, squawk 4250.
Cleared the Winona as filed, 6,000, expect 9,000, 10 minutes, 125.45, departure and 4250, 49 Victor.
Mooney 49 Victor, read back correct.
It almost sounded like I heard, Dan, you slurred your own end number at the end.
Yeah, just a little bit. You know, I think if you didn't know me, it sounded, you know, reasonable, but I had started to slide there.
So you took off, and you were then given the handoff by Duluth Tower to Duluth Departure.
Moody 9149 Victor, contact departure 125.45.
5-1-9 Victor.
We'll compress the time a little bit here, but it was a 17-second gap.
Good evening, departure Moody 9149 Victor. Climbing through 4,000.
Moody 49 Victor, you're still a tower. Departure is 125.45.
Right here, your actual frequency change took you 8 seconds. 8 seconds of silence here.
Good afternoon. Departure, Mooney 9149 Victor. Climbing through 4,300, 49 Victor.
49er Victor, departure radar contact. Turn left, direct Winona, maintain 900,000.
Left, direct Winona, up to 900,000, 49er Victor.
Did you have any inkling at that point that you were impaired?
Yeah, at that point I did, but I had no idea what was going on. So leading up to this, there was a few things that happened and came and went that were kind of reminiscent of the morning. I got that anxiety feeling after I put the landing gear up. I didn't understand that, but it was really short, didn't last very long. The headache at this point had went away and I felt fine, what I thought was fine. But when I slurred that end number, the callback, the slur had me thinking, what's going on? What's wrong with me? And at this point, my memory gets blurry. Everything starts happening really fast. And I remember thinking, you know, I got to go back and land. There's something wrong. I got to land, but I had no idea what it was. And I remember my thumb hovering over the autopilot disconnect button, just ready to push it and then head back. And then kind of the next thing I know, you know, I was kind of going along with the motions and they cleared me direct to my destination and up to 9,000 feet. And I read that back and that was, you know, shaky and I slurred. But I remember doing the motions in my autopilot and hitting direct and enter. And I normally would hit my GPS steer button at that point for the autopilot, and I didn't. And the very next thing is I'm waking up. And I just
so you were still on heading mode at the point at which you thought you had gone to GPS control.
Yeah. So I had it on heading, and I had the airplane trimmed in a climb. So this is all happening within about 4.5 minutes after I departed. So I was still climbing, and it was trimmed. That airplane did not have, it had altitude hold, but it didn't have any other vertical guidance for the autopilot. So it was just trimmed for a nice climb at about 105 knots or so, 120 miles an hour, and tracking a heading.
4,500 feet is the last thing you remember?
Yeah, it was right around that altitude. And then I remember waking up, and I immediately thought, I fell asleep for whatever reason. I had to tell ATC that I'm okay and that I need to go land. And I, you know, maybe they can help me figure out where I am. And so I started keying the mic and trying to, talk to anyone on ATC or on an ATC frequency, which I assumed I was still with. And while I was doing that, I was kind of looking forward and I noticed that my window is nice and clear. And usually there's all these, you know, bugs and swirl marks, and I'm always trying to keep my window as clean as I can. And I remember thinking, I've never seen it that clear before. This is amazing. And I reached forward to kind of touch it, and it wasn't there. And then that's when I kind of realized that I wasn't even flying anymore.
Goodness. You did not have a sense of no noise from the engine. That was not the giveaway. It was the fact that you could see and then did not feel the windscreen in front of you.
Exactly. So the airplane came to rest in a field, and it did so not, it was violent. I mean, it would have been violent. I wasn't part of it. I was just sleeping, but, so I had some head injury of some sort to the point where I heard a really loud ringing in my ears and at the time I couldn't differentiate that between engine noise and that I was injured.
Dan, let's get back to Flight Radar 24 that you mentioned. The questions that I have are, number one, did Flight Radar 24 tell you got to 9,000 feet? Or if you did it start climbing beyond that and then you were additionally hypoxic because of the lack of oxygen at altitude? Or did it run out of gas because there was no fire? How is it that you didn't go into a stall spin with that climb attitude and running out of gas? Why did you not just impact the ground and make a small hole in the ground? Do you have any idea how you were able to crash land with the attitude of the airplane normal? That's a lot to throw at you, but can you explain all of that?
Well, yeah. The first is luck. That's what everyone always tells me, or divine intervention. But yeah. Aerodynamically, it makes sense. It's back to your private pilot training or when you do constant airspeed climbs and descents and IFR training. When I lost consciousness, I was in a climb trimmed for about 105 knots. And when you trim an airplane, you're basically setting that airplane's angle of attack that it wants to fly at, which yields an airspeed. And if you change the power added, the airplane will either climb or it'll fly level or it'll descend, all depending on where it is in that power setting. And when I was climbing, I was full rich mixture and it was just trimmed. And fortunately, I had my autopilot on, keeping the wings level. That was all it was doing. And as it climbed, that full rich mixture got richer and richer and richer for the altitude, and I lost power. And I went right through that 9,000 feet, and it went up to about 12,500 feet. And about that's where it hit the point of equilibrium, where it couldn't, the amount of power at that trimmed speed yielded a level flight. And then it loitered along there for about an hour and 20 minutes or so. And then the tank that I had selected had ran out of gas. So I still had about 18 gallons in the other tank, but of course I was not awake to switch it.
You couldn't access it, right?
Right. And which I'm glad I couldn't, because much longer at that altitude, that hypoxic from carbon monoxide, I would have succumbed to that. So fortunately, ran out of gas just in time. And then you took the power away and the airplane descended at that same trimmed angle of attack, which was about 105 knots airspeed. And just by sheer luck, I made it into that field. The field was only about 800 feet long from power lines to trees.
Oh my goodness.
I just cleared the power lines and I just stopped short of the trees. So it worked out just perfect.
That is one of the most amazing combination of circumstances. Wow. Thank you. I just wondered how it was that you didn't become just a bunch of little pieces on the ground.
Well, I wonder that almost every day still, but, There's a lot of things that came together just to work out perfect for me.
Do you have any idea what the time frame was from the time you fell asleep, you're crossing through 4,500 feet, and the time you impacted the ground and the time you woke up?
Yeah, thanks to FlightAware, we can reconstruct all this. And based on the timestamps on FlightAware and the timestamps from ATC, that's how I know about where I passed out. And it was almost exactly 1.5 hours between losing consciousness and impacting the ground. From there on out, we don't know the time frame, but I believe I was on the ground unconscious for probably another 30 minutes.
And during that time, that's when you were able to get some oxygen back in. The engine had stopped. The windscreen was blown out and you were getting real air back into your system, real oxygen back in with the clean air.
Right. It came right at the right time. A lot of the doctors I spoke to, they assumed that if I was exposed another 30 minutes, I would have perished from the hypoxia, not even the impact. So it came just at the right time. And as I was, it was waking up, it was really slow and kind of dreamlike. I assumed that I was flying, and then I figured out I wasn't. And then I tried to kind of look around and get my surroundings. And I did see a searchlight in a field that was well off my right wing. And I assumed right away that that was for me. They were looking for me. So then I changed my focus to getting out of the airplane and trying to get to help. And I couldn't find anything. Before the flight, I put my headlamp on and I put my flashlight in the seat, and none of that was there anymore. My headlamp was gone. The flashlight, my gloves, the hat, everything was missing. You couldn't find anything. And so it was dark. None of the lights on the airplane worked. And then as I started to try to move around, I realized that I was stuck in the airplane too. I couldn't move my legs. I thought I was paralyzed. Turns out I wasn't, but my foot was trapped under the rudder pedal. It took a while to get that out. And then I got out of the plane and I thought, I'm going to head over and try to get to that light, which at this time I hadn't seen anymore. That searchlight I just saw right at the start of this.
But someone was looking for you because you said a helicopter was going by.
Yeah, and so there was a helicopter that went over a few times, and as time elapsed from me waking up, I was getting more and more cognitively aware of what was going on and kind of being able to put the pieces together. And so I knew that this helicopter was looking for me because, A, it had flown over a couple times, and it seemed to have been flying over straight east to west, west to east, doing kind of a pattern and moving, you know, moving one direction, whether it be south or north. But they were getting closer to me.
Did they ever spot you?
No. When they did fly directly overhead and did not see me. And my understanding was it was actually a medical helicopter that was told by ATC that an airplane was going down, and they were in the air, and they did what they could to help. They didn't have, obviously, a lot of the search and rescue type stuff that other search and rescue operations would be equipped with, so they would have heard my ELT, but I don't believe they had any sort of night vision or anything like that.
How were you finally rescued?
Well, after flopping around a field because I couldn't walk real well, so I'd walk and crawl and walk, and eventually I saw a light on a kind of through some woods on the other side of my airplane, and a couple outbuildings, and I assumed, or I hoped, I crossed my fingers and hoped that was a home, and I made my way to that, and it turned out it was, and I pounded on the window, and nice lady named Cynthia Crabtree lived there, and she let me in and immediately called the authorities. And then within just a few minutes, I had a sheriff's deputy there, and just a few minutes past that, some paramedics showed up, and they proceeded to stabilize me and drive me over back near where my airplane was and put me in the helicopter that was out flying around.
My goodness. Now, there are a couple of more questions I want to ask you about this. One is, as you became aware, let's talk about this in just a moment, of your hypoxia, of your injuries, back injuries and stuff. But you are also dealing with now not only getting out of hypoxia, but dealing with some frigid temperatures that could have taken your life. And, well, anyway, we'll take a break right now, Dan. And when we get back, we'll figure out what you learned about flying from that. We'll be right back. As a pilot, isn't it great to hear ATC say direct? Well, Avemco is America's only direct aircraft insurance company, and the only one that connects you directly with an underwriter empowered to make decisions, solve problems, and approve coverage based on your individual situation, not what some rule book says. Call Avemco at 800-338-8705, 800-338-8705, and learn about coverage personalized for what you fly and how you fly it. Now, back to I Laughed. We're back with Dan Bass, who survived a crash landing, not even aware that he had crash landed, coming to in an airplane after having been overcome by carbon monoxide and a serious case of carbon monoxide poisoning in the dead of winter at night in Minnesota. Dan, you had to have been injured very, very badly during that crash.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people see the pictures of my airplane and they think, wow, you landed and that's great. And they all even ask, did you get the airplane fixed? Well, Moonies are pretty stout machines, and there wasn't a four square inch area of that airplane that didn't have wrinkles in it. It was really wrecked, and the Moonie held together and kept me safe. But injury-wise, I impacted the ground pretty hard. You know, I was trimmed at 105 knots, so 120 miles an hour, and the airplane flew that all the way down to the ground. And so you can imagine a gear-up landing at 120 miles an hour is going to be violent. I ended up breaking a couple of vertebrae in my back. I broke my jaw, knocked some teeth out. My upper jaw was broken.
Oh, boy.
That was an artifact, I believe, of my iPad, you know, that we mount on the yoke sometimes. And then getting out of the airplane, I had some other little bangs and bruises. But because of the cold and because I couldn't find my hat and my gloves, I had some pretty severe frostbite on my hands. And then the other thing, it wasn't much of an injury, but it's a good point to think about, was that airplane had shoulder harnesses in it, and many of the
That
the
was going to be my next
don't.
Question. Tell me about your safety belt situation.
Right. So, unfortunately, I've always, before I take the runway, it's muscle memory now, I always cinch up the seat belts. And I must have did that because they did their job. And I had a shoulder harness, and it was added to this aircraft. This aircraft didn't come with it originally, just had the lap belt. And I had a diagonal bruise from my upper left shoulder all the way down that was there for a good month.
So it was not a 4-point, it was a 3-point system.
Yep, it was a 3-point, and it proved without a doubt to me that it saved my life. So incredibly important to have good restraints and shoulder harnesses particularly.
That's very interesting indeed. Well, that's one of the lessons learned. Make sure you got good seat belts and make sure you got them tightened up. What else can you share about what you learned about flying from that?
Well, this accident was stacked with all sorts of things to learn. First and foremost is carbon monoxide prevention. I was naive. I thought that I would understand and I would be able to tell. You know, I would be able to put the pieces together and know. And the problem is that forced hypoxia, its main thing is it attacks your cognitive ability. So by the time you're starting to have these symptoms, your cognitive ability isn't as strong as it should be to be able to put all the pieces together and figure out what's going on. Another thing is I would always assume that the symptoms would be linear, that I would start to get a headache and then the headache would get worse, and it would be this nice linear progression which would be easy to recognize. And it turns out it would come and go, and it would happen outside of the airplane. That was a real lesson learned. I had no idea how randomized it'd be, how easy it'd be to justify the symptoms, how they sneak up on you. And what I've learned since the accident is carbon monoxide, it attaches to your hemoglobin really, really strongly. It'll beat out oxygen, and then it doesn't let go for quite a long time. So the half-life, when they say, so if you get saturated with carbon monoxide, 4 to 5 hours later, your body's only gotten rid of about half of that. So with multiple leg flights, with lower exposures, it ratchets up. If you can follow me on that, you'll get some, and then maybe you take a break and you don't get rid of it fully. And then you build on that every flight. And that perfect storm, I think, is why I lost consciousness, 4.5 minutes after takeoff.
Gracious. Would you recommend having one of those stick-on CO detectors front and center on the panel?
Well, I personally don't recommend those at all. If they're in a perfect world, they do their job, but you have to see it and you have to recognize it and you have to understand that. If you're already getting impaired, you have to see that little thing change color, and in a cockpit at night, that might not work. What we're blessed with now is the inexpensive carbon monoxide detectors that are digital that we can get. And there's whole hosts of different ones. And some of them flash at you. Some of them will make noise. We have panel mount units now that can be integrated into our audio panel, and we can hear it over the headsets. There's lots of ways to do it. And it's so inexpensive now. It was ridiculous that I didn't have something. Everybody should. And I even recommend having two of them, because that way they kind of double check each other.
The insidious nature of carbon monoxide begs any kind of special equipment that would help detect it before it overtakes you.
Yeah. And one other thing, some of your listeners are going to be in Florida and Texas and California. And I've heard lots of people say, well, I don't even use my heater. It's never cold where I fly. And so they don't think it's as serious. Well, after this accident, I've dug into all the accident reports I could find. And the FAA did a study several years back, and they found that the time of year and the geographic location makes no difference to the the amount of CO accidents. So a faulty exhaust system, even when you're not running your heater and you're cruising around Texas, you could still be getting CO. So it's important for everybody to have a CO detector.
That is a great warning. Before we go, have you replaced the airplane?
I did replace the airplane. I bought another Mooney. I got a Mooney 231 this time, so I got turbocharged and a little more performance. So that's been nice. And I felt so comfortable in the Mooney and its role in protecting me in that accident. I just had to get another one.
Did you learn anything else?
The other thing I learned was the importance of survival equipment on you or fixed to the airplane so it doesn't move. Because in an accident, the inside of the airplane, it just gets rearranged. And that's where I made a mistake.
Well, as we close out, number one, I'm glad you got another airplane. I'm glad your old Mooney protected you in the crash. And I am super glad that you shared your lessons with us here on iLaft. Dan Bass, thank you so very much for being here.
Thanks, Rob. I really enjoyed it.
The simple fact that Dan survived the crash has given us some seriously valuable firsthand lessons that, had he perished, we might never have learned. I'm going to be changing the kind of CO detector I have in my plane. Thanks again, Dan. And thank you for listening. The folks at Flying Magazine have told me that lessons learned from the pilots who have told their stories have saved lives. So I hope you'll subscribe and share iLaft. You can follow iLaft on Flying Magazine, on Facebook or Instagram, where we'll post new episodes so everyone can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.